they call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street babes always leave the rest of them behind. Oh, so when Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your quotidian world has got you crying. Won't you two to one mind? Welcome to the Baker Street Babes podcast. My name is Jen, and I'm really, really lucky enough today to be sitting with Anthony Horowitz, who is the author of the new book, The House of Silk, which is a Sherlock Holmes novel. And full disclosure, I'm still 25 pages from the end, but it's a very good book, and I'm enjoying it so far, so thank you, Anthony, for joining me today.
Thank you, Jen.
I'm going to ask you the first thought of four basic babe questions. How did you get into Sherlock Holmes?
I was given the complete short stories and novels for my 16th or 17th birthday by my father.
Oh, okay. And you just plowed through them from there?
The first one I read was The Sign of Four, and I absolutely loved it. I just found the sort of the mystery so fantastic, and the atmosphere, the chase across the River Thames, the slightly outre characters. I loved the mix of sort of Indian colonialism and South London suburbs coming together.
Right.
And I was a fan from that moment on.
Oh, wow. Who's your favorite character?
In the stories, probably, that's such a difficult question because there are so many wonderful characters there. I mean, Holmes himself would have to be my favorite character, but Mycroft I might put a second close or second equal to Watson as well. Yeah, Holmes first, Watson second, Mycroft third.
Okay, yeah, that's, for a lot of people, I think that's probably the case. What's your favorite Sherlock Holmes story?
I've always had a real fondness for the dying detective. My story, The House of Silk, actually starts 3 days after The Dying Detective finishes.
Right.
The chronology in Holmes stories is difficult to pin down, but that was what was in my mind.
Right. Why is it your favorite story?
Because it's sort of a perfect little chamber piece, because I read it when I was very young and I was completely surprised by the ending. It's got such a sort of wonderful twist. The villain in it is really, really well drawn. I can't remember his name now. Milverton? Milverton, that's
yeah.
The one. And I just love the way that Watson is so bemused in it, and Holmes is so clever. The device of a little box that Holmes has been sent, I even use that in one of my stories, something quite similar.
Yeah.
So it's just a great story.
Right. And finally, what is your favorite adaptation of Sherlock Holmes?
I'm a big fan of Jeremy Brett, actually, the series that was done on BBC television throughout the 80s. At the moment, you might like to know that there is a campaign afoot to give Jeremy Brett a posthumous BAFTA award for his work,
definitely.
Which I very, very much support.
Yes, and we're in full support of it,
I think he was a terrific Holmes.
It's funny. I got into Sherlock Holmes because of the Sherlock BBC version that's going out right now. The second series is coming out with Benedict Cumberbatch and Martin Freeman. But then I started watching the Jeremy Brett series, and it blew me away. The quality that they did.
Yeah, Jeremy Brett was very, very fine in the role. Edward Hardwood was excellent as Holmes as well.
Yeah.
So was
David Burke, who was the first Watson.
No, of course, that's right. There were two
Watsons. Yeah.
And I'll give you a little piece of trivia that I bet you don't know. You can use this for future quizzes. In the Sherlock Holmes canon, which part has Jeremy Brett played? Which parts, plural?
Parts. Besides Holmes. Oh, wow, I don't know.
He has apparently also played the part of Watson against some big American actor. I'm going to say Charlton Heston, but it wasn't him. But look it up. Once played Watson on stage.
Interesting. That makes sense, though, for such a big character to also play the other side. Okay, so, all right, we're going to go on. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the book. How did this come about?
Well, this was simply an agent who approached me on behalf of the Conan Doyle estate, who had come together to provide a seal of approval for a new Sherlock Holmes novel, the first time it had ever happened. How they chose me, I don't know, because my first stipulation was that I wouldn't meet them, I wouldn't talk to them, I wouldn't have any notes from them, I wouldn't tell them what I was going to do, I wouldn't let them see the book when it was finished, They would get it when it was published and that was it. Now that may sound very mean and it may sound arrogant, but it's the way I work. I had to have complete independence. I had to write this book with the same care and fondness that I write all my own books.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so they just came up to you out of the blue and...
That's right.
Approached you and...
That's absolutely right.
Now, I read in an interview that you, in the first meeting, by the end of the meeting, you had the plot for the book.
That is absolutely true. I didn't have all of it. There were some little details that came later. You might like to know that the American sequence that opens the books was originally going to be 5 chapters long. And I had that all plotted out and planned. And that very much follows the study in Scarlet and The Valley of Fear, both of which have very extended American sequences, and I was going to do the same thing. In the end, I realized I could do it all in one chapter, so that was one of the changes I made. Mm-hmm. But it's absolutely true to say that that virtually all the plot, I would say about 80% of it, had come by the end of the first meeting.
Interesting. So what inspired you for the plot?
Well, a lot of things. I mean, first of all, there had been a real scandal in 1891 that I'd always been aware of. I'm not going to say what it is, because I don't want to give away the plot of the book. But I'd always known about this and thought it would make an interesting subject for a story. So that was one of the elements that came in. And there were other things. There was the murder mystery element of the book, because it's quite a tangled and quite... I hope your readers will find it quite an involving and complex structure to this book. But there is a murder mystery story to it, which had also been in my head for some time, this idea of a particular sort of murder. And that also just fell in and began to mould itself into this book. So these were ideas already in my head that I saw I could use. But what was great was the way they sort of began immediately to change shape and sort of to spread their tentacles across the House of Silk.
Right. It's not exactly complex, but it's very widespread because your murder mystery is also a larger conspiracy.
Well, what you've got in this story is basically two novellas. Now, this is a conscious decision because the Sherlock Holmes novels, as you know, are only about 40,000 words in length. They're very short. The longest one is The Hound of the Baskervilles, coming in at about 43, mm-hmm. 44. Now, my commission from the start was to produce a book of 90,000 words because that is the length of a modern novel. And so the first challenge I had was how do I stretch the very delicate framework of a Conan Doyle novel structure to a modern novel length. And to do that, the idea I came up with was to do not one, but two stories. One was going to be called The House of Silk, the other is The Man in the Flat Cap. And these two stories are so inextricably linked that hopefully no reader can tell where one starts and the other, as it were,
right,
continues. And this is what also flummoxes Holmes in the course of this investigation. I have to say that for me, a good murder mystery, when I talk about it being complex, what I mean is this. The structuring, my work, the sort of the bolting it down, is complex. It took me a lot of time to get everything in order. When you read it, however, it should feel anything but. I don't want readers to think that they're going to have to sort of, you know, puzzle and stymie their way through this book, going back to see what's going on. It's actually a very, very easy, even a linear read, but it has within it concealed a very, very complex structure.
Right. How did you prepare to write this novel? Did you do a lot of research?
I didn't do a lot of research. No, I just reread the whole canon. What a great pleasure to have just an excuse to sit down
right, exactly,
and read all 56 short stories, one after another, in the correct order, and then to read the 4 novels as well. That was, a great, great pleasure, and just to reacquaint myself with Holmes and to start sort of thinking about how I was going to approach this task. The second thing I did was to read a couple of books about 19th century London, which I've acknowledged in the front cover, the 2 books that I read. And I'm fortunate because all my life I've read 19th century literature. Ever since I've been in my 20s, I've loved Charles Dickens, George Gissing, George Meredith, Anthony Trollope, and many, many other 19th century writers. So it's really in my blood, and I was quite surprised how easily it all came. On top of that, however, I did use a researcher for the first time in my writing career. I was in a hurry to write this book and just didn't have time to immerse myself in libraries. So what I would do is I would send this guy questions. What's it like inside an opium den? What is police procedure for somebody arrested in the 19th century? What's it like in a prison? All these sorts of questions to which he would provide answers. What was great about what he did was he only ever sent me 19th century answers. He didn't answer the questions himself. He found source material. So, for example, there is a large sequence in the book taking place in a prison, and the prison is described through the eyes of a prison governor who had visited that prison a few years before. I read the report on the prison and was able to use details of it mm-hmm. to create what is in the book.
Right. Interesting. That's... to kind of immerse yourself into that world and have somebody help you along with it. Were you at all daunted by the task, nervous by it? I mean, Sherlock Holmes is such a beloved character.
It may surprise you, Bill, but I wasn't particularly daunted. And I hate to sound arrogant, but I knew from the very start I could do this. I'll put it another way. I'm a great lover of Sherlock Holmes. I mean, I know that you and your organization and your society are also great fans. So you understand that sense of wanting to protect him, that when we see movies and adaptations that take liberties with the original text, we feel a little pain, a little hurt. I mean, I'm not necessarily referring to the Robert Downey Jr. films, for example, but, you know, any Sherlockian knows that that really has got nothing really very much to do with the character that we also love. So my first determination was that I would work within the canon and I would really respect everything that Doyle had done. I forget now what your original question was.
But, were you daunted at all?
But I wasn't daunted because I knew I could do it. If I had felt that I was going to muck things up, I would have stopped. I would have not gone ahead. And I can tell you that I actually wrote the introduction to this book, as it appears in the book, which is Watson's introduction, before I signed the contract. And I had 5 pages of manuscript, which I took to the publisher. I said, I want you to read this. And if you really think it's good enough, then I'll sign the contract. But I'm not signing until we all agree that this is spot on right. And they liked it, and they read it, they loved it, in fact, and I signed and then wrote the book.
Right. How long did it take for you to write the book?
Very, very fast, right? Only about 3 to 4 months. And that's about half or less of my usual writing time. All I can say is that I was so inspired by what I had been given. You see, it's not that difficult when you've been given two of the greatest characters in English fiction. The greatest detective that ever was. A whole range of minor characters who can people your novel. This wonderful language. You've got the topography. You've got 19th century London. The fog, the cobblestones, the river, the horses, the gas lamps, the opium dens. Everything is there. So it wasn't like starting from scratch and having to invent everything. It was simply having to live with what I had. And I loved it. I enjoyed every single minute of the writing. And when I got to the last page of the book, and it ends on a slightly sad note, that sadness is what I felt, knowing I'd come to the end.
That you've let go of everything that you had in you. Had you thought about writing a Sherlock Holmes pastiche prior to this?
I sort of take exception slightly at the word pastiche in your question. And I'll tell you why. I know you don't mean any offensive thing by it. But I think of a pastiche as being something very light, very half-considered, something which often is either funny or silly. There are many, many pastiches of Sherlock Holmes. Sherlock Holmes meets Dracula. Sherlock Holmes meets Tarzan. Herlock Sholmes. Arsene Lupin did some, Sherlock Holmes pastiche. What I have done is closer, first of all, to homage, which I hope you get the distinction and the difference.
Mm-hmm.
And also what I'd like to think is that The House of Silk is, at the end of the day, a highly original work, despite living in the world of Doyle. One of the main differences being that my Watson is much, much older than the Watson in the books. Therefore, there is a poignancy and a sort of a deeper analysis in the book than you find in the originals. I'm not saying, incidentally, that mine is better than the originals. It couldn't hope to be, but it is trying to be different. It's trying to be original on its own 2 feet, as it were. So when I hear the word pastiche, I've used it myself in interviews.
Mm-hmm.
I always stop myself short and try to explain that I really, really hope that readers who come to this book will find something more and pastiche in it.
That it's your homage to these.
No, but it's more than that. But it is an original book. But it is what my aim was that it was as if Doyle had written another book. But it could live. But you know that I'm invisible. Yes, my name is all over the cover of the book, and here I am talking to you. That's because Doyle is no longer with us. But I'm the whole impetus of the book was that it should really feel like an addition to the canon, not a modern writer doing something, whether it is pastiche, satire, homage, or rip-off of the original, but it is actually an original book. That was what my whole aim was. I'm sorry if I sound over-assertive on this, but I'm very proud of The House of Silk, and as I've said, I so love the Doyle world that I feel almost bound to defend myself.
No, it's your right as an author, you know, somebody who's put all that work into the book to do that.
You can't see on this podcast, but we're both smiling at each other. This interview is not turning sour.
No, it's not. It's definitely not. How did writing this book differ from all the other works that you've done? You're most notable for the Alex Rider series. You've also done a lot of TV mysteries, Midsummer Murders, Foyle's War. Was there anything different about the process, the way you you know, move forward?
I think I've already answered this question in a way. I mean, it was a much faster book to write. It wasn't easier, but it was a very comfortable and joyful experience to write. I didn't find myself struggling for words or for clues or for descriptions or for dialogue. And I almost felt, and I have to be careful here, I am not myself a spiritualist. I don't believe in life after death. Of course, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle did. And when I was writing this book, I had next to me, by the way, an old copy. I went out and bought a very old book of Sherlock Holmes, signed by Doyle. That's the point. Mm-hmm. An edition signed by Doyle. And I kept it next to me as a talisman. And the big difference was that I almost felt myself being guided in the writing of this book. I mean, it's difficult exactly to describe, and again, I don't want to sound sort of, you know, I don't want to sound as if I'm exaggerating anything, but it was just as if there was this presence looking over my shoulder, guiding my hand in what I wrote, and I never felt that I was alone. I always felt that Doyle was somehow with me.
Right. So, would you say that the original Sherlock Holmes stories isn't over... overall for you was a big influence on you deciding to become a writer?
No, I'd already decided to be a writer before I came to Sherlock Holmes. I knew at the age of 8 I was going to be a writer. It may have helped push me towards murder mystery, although, to be honest with you, I think murder mystery was built into me anyway. I've always loved mysteries, puzzles, riddles. I love fooling the reader. I love pace, adventure, excitement. I like stories that are unpredictable. I particularly like great twists at the end. My first question to you when we met today was, how'd you guess the ending?
Yeah,
and you've
right.
still got to get to it. You've
no,
got to
I'm
leave me
there.
And you've got to
I'm
go
almost
and
there.
And leave it
on I'm almost there. Now, you just mentioned that you felt like Arthur Conan Doyle was sort of with you along this journey. Do you think he would approve of the book if he was around to read The House of Silk?
I can't answer that because we're putting words into his mouth. I would hope so. I really would hope so. Because, I mean, one of the things I have noticed is that I have spoken to a great many Sherlockians in America and Holmesians in England, which is what they're called,
right.
And I've spoken now to yourself, and I also spoke to a couple of Doyle experts in America, and they have all taken to this book in a very, very big way. I mean, they really have embraced it wholeheartedly. And I think that answers your question. So the people who best know Doyle's work are happy with what I've done and aren't upset and angry and sort of feeling bruised, as one can do, then I think I've achieved what I set out to.
Right. Okay. Speaking of Sherlockians and Holmesians, have you felt overwhelmed at all by the amounts of us who, you know, have kind of come out to talk to you about this book?
Was it
a surprise or anything?
It is a little surprising, yes. I hadn't realized how many different societies there are. I mean, the Baker Street Babes is one, but then there's a Moriarty Society, there's a Sherlock Holmes Society, which is where I actually announced the book in the House of Parliament in
mm-hmm.
London in January of this year. And there are many, many other societies as well around the characters. But, you know, this is one of the great things about books of this stature and this sort of, and this worth. You know, we're not talking here about junk literature. We're talking about one of the great diamonds in the sort of in the world, in the showroom of English literature, if you like.
Right.
And I think it is really heartening that in a modern age where everything is so disposable and so fast and where people's interests seem to sort of flicker and wane like the flicker of a switch, that there are societies around who have this sort of deep felt passion for these books, and I'm delighted to have met some of them, and I can't wait to meet more.
It's weird for us to, you know, we started this podcast not, you know, 7 months ago, and to be embraced and be welcomed into this community. It's a very welcoming community.
And
they want to get to know you.
We're all
female, yeah.
Yeah, because we're babes.
Yeah, but it's a very welcoming.
So it should be.
People.
I mean, of course it is, because, you know, literature. But why do I spend so much of my life trying to persuade young people to read and trying to promote literature and literacy? It is because if you read books and if you talk about books, you have a sort of a sense of humanity that you would otherwise lack. And of course, you know, the Sherlock Holmes world is a very large one. There are no rival factions. Everybody is welcome. It's part of the charm. It's part of the achievement of Doyle himself.
Yeah, considering that there was always so much of a legal battle going on behind the Doyle estate.
Well, that is unfortunately
true.
That is unfortunately true, but, you know, that's another issue. Because, of course, when it comes to money and to contracts and to control,
right.
then different rules come into play.
Right.
But as I have already said, I had absolutely nothing to do with any of that. I just want to talk to
right.
you
no,
and to the readers and to people who, like me, love Sherlock Holmes.
Right, exactly. Which is what's really great about the Sherlock Holmes fans and the Holmesians
yes,
and everybody.
Exactly.
They get together and that's what they want to discuss. Yeah.
Well, I would hate to think of a war. Oh, is this a novel? A war between the Sherlockians and the Holmesians. Murders taking place. Now, actually, it's quite an interesting idea.
Transatlantic. And also in doing some research before this interview, I found that you had 10 rules for yourself when you were writing this novel.
That is correct.
And some of them included no over-the-top action, using the right language, not too many murders. But I think my favorite was actually rule number 10.
Which I can tell you was never be photographed wearing a deerstalker cap or smoking a pipe. As any Holmesian or Sherlockian will know, Holmes never wore a deerstalker cap in the books. In one story, and I forget which one it is, it might be Copper Beaches, he's seen wearing a hat for the country. But in London, he would not have worn a deerstalker hat, certainly not in 1890. It was added afterward by Sidney Paget.
Right, but which we actually is our previous episode. We actually talked about his artwork and the influence that he had on that, including
which was huge.
The, yeah.
And his work was very, you know, I'm not knocking it. It's a wonderful image to have and such. But nonetheless, in the actual books, it doesn't exist, as we all know. But I just didn't want to make a fool of myself, you know. I mean, when Sebastian Faulks launched his James Bond novel, he was photographed going up the River Thames in a motorboat with a bunch of Bond lovelies. And he looked such a prat that I was determined that I would not have a photo of me sitting in a hansom cab with a coke and a hat looking equally silly.
Well, which definitely makes sense. So I'm guessing then you don't own a deerstalker.
No, but my wife did buy me a very nice Sherlock Holmes-style pipe.
Oh, okay.
Just to have on my shelf as a congratulations on getting published.
Oh, well, that's good. That was a very nice gift from your wife.
I don't smoke my haste to have it.
That's great. Let's see. So I wanted to go back to the what makes this book just a little bit different, because the book on the front cover has this seal
yes.
of the Sherlock Holmes Conan Doyle Estate Ltd. Mm-hmm. There have been other Sherlock Holmes novels that have been approved by the estate, and I'm wondering what makes yours different from some of the other books that have been approved.
As I said, I'm not really the right person to ask about this, because I don't, to be honest with you, know. Okay. I think the difference is that this time the estate had the idea and came to an author, rather than an author having the idea and going to the estate. Maybe that is the difference. This makes this book, as it were, authorized / commissioned. I use the word seal of approval. And you seem to know more about the sort of a legal situation than I do. I've only met a couple of members of the estate since the book was published. They seem perfectly pleasant people, and I've been delighted that they've responded positively to the book. But as to the sort of how this all began, I just don't really know. Honestly, nor do I care. You know, it came to me, would I like to do it? It took me about 5 seconds to decide I'd absolutely love to. And I did it, and I think I've done a good job. So, you know, the actual sort of ins and outs of how it all began seems to me to be a little irrelevant. To me, anyway.
Right, because you as the author were set out to just write a good book and to enjoy doing it at the same time.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's a great book, and I definitely do recommend for Sherlockians to go out there and read. I am enjoying it, even though I am 25 pages from the end. I will finish it today.
Why haven't you got to the end before you met me?
Because I didn't get this book very just a little while ago. Yeah. It went through two other babes before it got to me.
Oh,
and, yes, so two
and
others
have read.
They did enjoy it, yes.
Good.
So, yes, we definitely had a lot of good fun reading it. So, and I was going to stay up really late last night to attempt to finish it.
No worry.
But
no worries at all. Well, I hope also when you read it, because there are lots of things in there just for you, for people who really know Sherlock Holmes, there are lots of jokes and little inward references and little secrets that are mentioned. You know, some of them are sort of tiny details, like Lestrade having his first name revealed for the first time.
Right.
It's things like that the only people who really know the books well will look at and be able to smile at and say, oh, yeah, I know what you're doing here.
Now, was that part of, as you were writing it, that was, to you, it was not only just an inside joke to yourself as an author who was writing it, but realizing that the readers would enjoy it as well?
Yes, I think, you know, my first loyalty was to the estate and to the fans of Sherlock Holmes. But obviously I have a very much wider responsibility to provide a really brilliant book that, you know, a bigger readership will enjoy, and hopefully afterwards return to Doyle because of me, which would be a fantastic outcome. Nothing when I write is planned. I'm not a sort of a mechanical, do-it-by-numbers, hit-the-right-spots type writer. I write what I believe in and what seems fun at the time. But part of the fun was to sort of send little clues to other Sherlock Holmes fans to say, you know, spot the story, spot the reference.
Right, right. And it is. I mean, it's throughout the novel, there'll be little things that'll crop up. And I found myself when I was reading it, I was like, oh, yeah, I remember that. Or I'd see a name that was familiar, and I'd be like, wait, why do I know that name? And then it would bring back...
Of course.
Yeah.
And the first chapter is a straight reference to the story of The Adventure of the Cardboard Box, where Holmes merely looks at Watson and can immediately tell him everything that he's been doing for the last 24
right.
hours. I had to have a section in it like that because it's one of my favorite things when I was a kid.
Right. Now, did you have trouble now coming up with sort of the deductions that Sherlock does in your novel? In hearing interviews that Mark Gatiss and Stephen Moffat, who are the current writers for the Sherlock BBC version, say they love being able to do the little deduction scenes where Sherlock, you know, can pick things out and it points him in the right direction. But after a while, it feels like, what else can we point out? What else does he know? It almost seems like that there's a limit to what can... that.
Well, Stephen Moffat is a very good friend of mine, by the way, and I know very well sort of, you know, the inner workings of Sherlock on the BBC, which I like very much, incidentally. I only had to do it once. Don't forget, they're running 6 episodes, and they're probably going to continue for as long as the series is popular, which could be forever. So I didn't have to worry too much about, you know, doing it, because I did it once, and I did it, I hope, well. You know, but the clues within the Sherlock Holmes canon are not that varied. Doyle uses a lot of devices several times. Often it'll be a mark of some sort on the sleeve. It'll be mud. Sitting in an open hansom cab, if you sit on the right, you get more mud on your right leg. If you sit on your left, you get more on your left. But then he'll add to that maybe where the mud comes from. You know, he'll know of a certain type of clay in a certain part of the country, which is also on the shoes. You know, because he lived in a 19th century environment where we don't have all the sort of apparatus that we carry around with us, which give much bigger clues. Looking at you, there's your tape recorder, there's your watch over there, there's your bag with its umbrella on the floor there. You know, Holmes would have a field day with you, I'm absolutely sure.
Oh.
but in the 19th century, there was less to go on, because there just was. And because I was writing in the 19th century, it was therefore probably easier for me than it is for Stephen.
Right, yeah, well, and dealing with technology and everything these days, too.
Yes.
Having that to go along with. So this is kind of a silly question. If you could have tea with anyone from the canon, who would it be?
Sherlock Holmes. There's no answer to that, is there, Arthur? Well, who would you? I mean, if you were the choice. Maybe Moriarty would be fun to have tea with Moriarty.
Do you know, I'd almost want to have tea with Mrs. Hudson, because I feel like she might know a lot more than is revealed in the books.
Well, you can always go and visit the house at 221B Baker Street in London.
I have been there.
And although they don't serve tea, you can talk to Sherlock Holmes or to Dr. Watson, depending
yes.
on who is there that day.
Yep, I did. I met Dr. Watson that day.
Right.
He was there sitting in the sitting room, enjoying a nice little fire, taking photos with everybody. So that was great. Let's see if I've got through all my questions. Something I noticed about the book, it's a very dark tale. At least I felt it was. And what I mean is that it was a very... It felt a little darker than, like, some of Arthur Conan Doyle's stories
yeah.
had a little bit more dark side to it.
First,
some were a little bit more whimsical.
Let us start by saying that Conan Doyle wrote some extremely dark stories. If you're not acquainted with his horror stories, you should certainly read them, because they're darker than anything you'll find in a house of silk. I began from the point of view, a very simple point of view. This book is written, has not been found for many, many years. It has been hidden in a vault in London for 100 years. What on earth was going on that Watson felt he had to protect us from? So by its very nature, it had to be something very disturbing, very scandalous, something very far-reaching. Otherwise, the book wouldn't have existed. So it was built in from the start.
Was that kind of your intention from the beginning when you started to write the book, that you wanted to write something that was maybe perhaps just a little bit more...
No, it wasn't at all. But I didn't have any intentions before I started writing this book.
Okay.
I was asked to write this book, and when I was asked to write it, my only intention was to serve Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, to provide a new book that would please people and lead them to back to the Doyle canon.
But what I'm actually talking about, though, is like when you came up with the plot and it popped into your head, did you think that, wow, that's kind of, that seems, that was really,
no. I'm sitting in a room with an agent who says, do you want to do a Sherlock Holmes novel? And because of the way I work, my head immediately begins to start thinking about what might be in that novel. And before 5 seconds have passed, I know it's got to be something, as I say, dark and sinister, because otherwise there's no reason for this book to not exist, to have been hidden. So that's my first thing. I'm already beginning to think about the length of the book, and I think to myself, I've got to have two stories, not one, so I can have one story that's very dark, and the other story which is perhaps a little bit lighter. So you've got the Keelan O'Donoghue and the Flat Cap Gang, which is a Boston Irish gangsters, which is quite a fun story, very, very much in keeping with the sort of thing you find in the Valley of Fear and in A Study in Scarlet. At the same time, I've got this other story, which is the House of Silk, which is a secret organization based in London, which is more conspiratorial and darker and can affect the whole of London's society, which Watson has to keep quiet about. And the two stories, as he says in the introduction, are so inextricably linked that you can't have one without the other, so he presents both. I then start thinking about which characters I can use. Oh, this is an opportunity to visit Mycroft, to have Moriarty, but should he be the villain? Well, no, it's a lovely idea. I'd love to have Moriarty as a villain, but it's a bit obvious, isn't it? Maybe I can use him. I know how I can use him. I'll use him in the way that he is used in this book. Mm-hmm. I must have Mycroft. What could he do? How about a bit of romance? Shall we have a romance in here? Would it be nice to have a new girlfriend for Holmes? These are the thoughts that are going through my head as I'm talking to the agent. And a voice says, no, you can't have a girlfriend, because we know from a scandal in Bohemia that for Holmes she was always the woman, there was only Irene Adler.
Right.
So we're not going to have Irene Adler turn up again, because that would also seem a little bit cheap. Shall we have drugs? Am I going to have Holmes injecting himself? Well, I don't think I want to do that, because I like Holmes because he's a great thinker, because he's so rational and cool and aloof and collected. I don't want to write stories of him rolling about on the floor. And anyway, Nicholas Meyer did that in the 7.5% solution back in 1980-something. So all these thoughts turning in my head. Now, your question seems to suggest, and forgive me, that I had some kind of plan in my head. I didn't.
That was
a response to this idea, to this suggestion, this assignment. And as I can only reiterate, all I wanted to do was to write a really good, pacey, exciting, modern thriller that nonetheless would stay 100% true to one of the greatest writers who ever lived, a writer much, much greater than me. And that I didn't want to take liberties, I didn't want to do anything that would upset people who love those stories. And that is how The House of Silk was born, in a nutshell.
Wow.
Can we stop there?
I've got one more question, and it's just a simple one. Do you plan on writing any more Sherlock Holmes novels, or do you think for you...
This is it. Yeah, The House of Silk is the only one I'm going to write. And the reason for that is that I think it's the best job I could have done. And if I try and do it again, I know I won't do it as well a second time. You know, lightning doesn't strike twice. Not exactly, anyway. So I don't want to write a book which everybody simply compares to the first book and says, hey, this isn't so good. Secondly, I'm worried it would be a little bit cynical. You know, to do a one Sherlock Holmes book as an act of devotion is fine. To do another to get a big paycheck is not so honest or pure. So that's a second reason not to do it. What I do have in mind is a novel set in 19th century in which Sherlock Holmes will make a very fleeting appearance, maybe in sort of just a paragraph. But it's therefore going to be his world, maybe one or two of his characters, but not a Sherlock Holmes story.
Will we see that anytime soon, or is this...
I plan to start writing it. These books are best written in the cold. So I plan to start writing it probably at the end of next year for publication in 2013.
All right. Well, Anthony Horowitz, I want to thank you very, very much for joining me today.
It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I hope I haven't come across as too forceful. This is a work of passion.
It comes across very clearly that you put a lot of love and a lot of passion into what was going on.
I hope your readers will enjoy it, and I have plenty to talk about when they finish.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right.
Hey, Americans, do any of you live in Oklahoma? Well, there's a science society in Tulsa called the Afghanistan Perceivers, and they want some young blood. The Afghanistan Perceivers is a signed society or affiliated chapter of the National Baker Street Irregulars. It has members in Tulsa and other towns in Oklahoma, and by correspondence with those out of state. The purpose of the society is to keep green the memory of Sherlock Holmes. The group meets regularly through two divisions. The Brown Bagatelle Club is a discussion group that meets for lunch the first Friday of each month at 11:30 a.m., and the Central Press Syndicate is a discussion group that meets for dinner on the fourth Thursday of each month at 6:30 p.m. You can find out more about the Afghanistan Perceivers at www.angelfire.com/ok5/perceivers. Go and check it out.
A reminder that you can help save Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's home in Hindhead, Surrey by supporting the Undershaw Preservation Trust. It was at Undershaw that he wrote The Hound of the Baskervilles and The Return of Sherlock Holmes, and entertained many notable people, including Bram Stoker, the author of Dracula, J.M. Barrie, the creator of Peter Pan, and the young Virginia Woolf. Today, Undershaw stands sorrowfully empty, neglected, and vandalized. Waverly Borough Council have granted the owners planning permission to carve up the literary historic house into three flats, with five more homes built on its side. Modern townhouses, or maintained as the single dwelling that Conan Doyle designed and had built. The Undershaw Preservation Trust is vigorously working towards the latter. And you can help by visiting www.saveundershaw.com, as well as following them on Twitter and joining their Facebook campaign. Thank you.
If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you too?